Unit 15.
Text 1. Teaching as Mountaineering by Nancy K. Hill. Just recently, a committee meeting at the University of Colorado was interrupted by the spectacle of a young man scaling the wall of the library just outside the window. Discussion of new interdisciplinary courses halted as we silently hoped that he had discipline enough to return safely to the earth. Hope was all we could offer from our vantage point in Ketchum Hall, the impulse to rush out and catch him being checked by the realization of futility. The incident reinforced my sense that mountaineering serves as an apt analogy for the art of teaching. The excitement, the risk, the need for rigorous discipline all correspond, though the image I have in mind is not that of the solitary adventurer rappelling off a wall, but that of a Swiss guide leading an expedition. I remember a mountaineer named Fritz who once led a group up by the Jungfrau at the same time a party was climbing the north face of the Eiger. My own mountaineering skill was slender, and my enthusiasm would have faltered had I not felt Fritz was capable of hauling not only me, but all the rest of us off that mountain. Strong, self-assured, calm, he radiated that solid authority that encouraged me to tie on to his rope. But I soon realized that my presence on his line constituted a risk for Fritz. Had I been so foolhardy as to try to retrieve my glove, which went tumbling off a precipice, or had I slipped into one of those inexplicably opening crevices, I might well have pulled the noble Fritz down with me. It was a sobering realization. I, the novice, and he, the expert, were connected by the same lifeline in an experience of mutual interdependence. To give me that top-of-the-world exaltation, he too was taking a risk. The analogy to teaching seems to me apt, and not just for professors who happen to live in Colorado, for the analogy implies an active acceptance of responsibility for one's own fate, whereas most other analogies to teaching suggest passivity. What is needed to restore teachers' confidence that the profession is significant is a new analogy, a new metaphor. I shy away from the PR word image, that conveys more of the essence of teaching than the worn-out analogies we have known. Most previous analogies are seriously inadequate. For a while, they may describe a part of the teaching activity. They also suggest patterns that are not fully applicable to teaching. It is not a simple matter, for those faulty analogies create misunderstandings about the professor's role, not only in the lay public, but in the professoriate itself. These wrong analogies have contributed to growing demoralization within the profession and have confused the difficult issue of proper evaluation. The most common analogies to the teacher are the preacher, the shepherd, the curator, the actor, the researcher, and most insidiously, the salesman. None captures the special relationship between teacher and students, a relationship better described by Socrates as a coming together of friends. Rather than emphasizing the mutuality of the endeavor, each of these common analogies turns on a separation between the professional and his clients. Each leads to a certain kind of evaluation. The preacher exhorts, cajoles, pleads with a congregation, often so benighted as to exist in a state of somnolence. He measures his success by the number of souls so stirred as either to commit themselves to his cause or vehemently to reject it. Somewhat like the preacher is the shepherd, who gathers and watches over a flock clearly inferior to himself. The analogy may be apt for the Lord and his sub-angelic followers, but it will not do for teacher and students, or especially for Socrates and his friends. The shepherd is likely to be evaluated by the gulf separating his wisdom from that of his flock. If the poor country curate has often furnished an analogy to the bleating professor, so has the curator of a museum. Lips purse so as to distill a purer essence of hauteur. The curator, as connoisseur, points out the rarities of classical cultures to the uninitiated, who can scarcely be expected to appreciate these finer things. Since they cannot understand him anyway, the curator has no compunction about sprinkling his presentation with Latin and Greek, and with English so esoteric as to sound foreign. Chances are high that the professor, as connoisseur, will succeed in convincing most of the class that the subject is really the province of a secret society, With its own arcane practices and language, best left behind its own inaccessible walls. Indeed, colleagues of the connoisseur measure his success by the paucity of devotees allowed into the society through this winnowing process. The teacher as actor also plays to a passive audience, but he measures success by larger numbers. A certain aura of the magician clings to him as he lures spectators into witnessing his academic sleight of hand, without their ever really getting in on the trick. A certain tinge of the stand-up comedian colours the performance as the actor plays the audience to register laughs big enough to drown out the lecturer droning on next door. A bastardized version of the actor is that figure now thought so apt an analogy in our consumer-conscious society, the salesman. His predecessors include the snake oil man and the door-to-door purveyor of anything from brushes to Britannicas. He or she takes the product to the people, wherever they are, and tailors the pitch to their pockets. While all of these analogies create a certain level of despair in the professoriate, either struggling to pattern themselves in a particular mode or hopelessly realizing they can never achieve it, the salesman analogy has the most deleterious effects. No longer adhering even to a prepared script, the salesman shamelessly alters his or her presentation so that it will draw the largest number of contented consumers. The researcher as teacher differs from the previous analogies, and that very distinction is often thought to make him or her a good teacher. Taciturn, solitary, he disdains the performing arts and is content merely to mutter out an assortment of scattered facts to the young, only dimly perceived beyond his clouded trifocals. His measure of success is his students' capacity to regurgitate factual data. None of these analogies comes close to the essential magic and majesty of a real learning experience. None even dimly anticipates that self-eradicating feature that is built into the teaching process. For those who have truly mastered what their teacher has presented, no longer need him or her. None accepts as a necessary ingredient in the learning process activity the sense of an intellectual excitement so compelling that one's whole being is caught up in it. None acknowledges the peril and the joy of encountering those mental deeps Hopkins described. The mind. Mind has mountains, cliffs of fall, frightful, sheer, no man fathomed. Hold them cheap, may who ne'er hung there. Mountaineering furnishes the needed analogy. The Swiss mountain guide, like the true teacher, has a quiet authority about his person. He or she engenders trust and confidence so that one is willing to join the endeavour. The mountaineer accepts his leadership role, yet recognises that the success of the journey, measured by the scaling of the heights, depends upon close cooperation and active participation by each member of the group. He has crossed the terrain before and is familiar with the landmarks, but each trip is new and generates its own anxiety and excitement. Essential skills must be mastered if the trip is to be successful. Lacking them, disaster looms as an ominous possibility. The very precariousness of the situation necessitates keen focus and rapt attention. Slackness, misjudgment, or laziness can bring doom. The teacher as mountaineer learns, as E.M. Forster urged, to connect. The guide rope links mountaineers together so that they may assist each other in the ascent. The effective teacher does something similar by using the oral and written contributions of the students as instructional materials. The teacher also makes other connections, locating the text in its historical setting, forging inter- and intradisciplinary links where plausible, joining the material of the course with the lives of the students where possible, and with the wider national life beyond the classroom where pertinent. Teaching as mountaineering does not encourage the yellow lecture note syndrome. Indeed, the analogy does not really encourage lecturing at all. If the student as mountaineer is to be challenged, the student must come to each class session ready and prepared to assist in scaling the next peak, ready to test his or her own abilities against those of the master teacher. Only by arduous and sustained effort does the student approach the mastery of the teacher, and only then is the student ready to assume the role of guide, well-trained in the art of mountaineering, able to take controlled risks, ready to lead others to the mountaintop experience. Not a huckster, not a performer, not a pleader, but a confident, exuberant guide on expeditions of shared responsibility. To encourage and further such mountaintop experiences, the Society must recognise teaching for the sublime art it is, not merely an offshoot of research, not merely a performance before a passive audience, but a guided expedition into the most exciting and least understood terrain on Earth, the mind itself.
Text 2. A Liberal Education by Thomas H. Huxley. Suppose it were perfectly certain that the life and fortune of every one of us would one day or other depend upon his winning or losing a game of chess. Don't you think that we should all consider it to be a primary duty to learn at least the names and the moves of the pieces, to have a notion of a gambit and a keen eye for all the means of giving and getting out of check? Do you not think that we should look with a disapprobation amounting to scorn upon the father who allowed his son, or the state which allowed its members, to grow up without knowing a pawn from a knight? Yet it is a very plain and elementary truth that the life, the fortune, and the happiness of every one of us, and, more or less, of those who are connected with us, do depend upon our knowing something of the rules of a game infinitely more difficult and complicated than chess. It is a game which has been played for untold ages, every man and woman of us being one of the two players in a game of his or her own. The chessboard is the world. The pieces are the phenomena of the universe. The rules of the game are what we call the laws of nature. The player on the other side is hidden from us. We know that his play is always fair, just, and patient. But also we know, to our cost, that he never overlooks a mistake or makes the smallest allowance for ignorance. To the man who plays well, the highest stakes are paid, with that sort of overflowing generosity with which the strong shows delight in strength. And one who plays ill is checkmated without haste, but without remorse. My metaphor will remind some of you of the famous picture in which Retzsch has depicted Satan playing at chess with man for his soul. Substitute for the mocking fiend in that picture a calm, strong angel who is playing for love, as we say, and would rather lose than win. And I should accept it as an image of human life. Well, what I mean by education is learning the rules of this mighty game. In other words, education is the instruction of the intellect in the laws of nature, under which name I include not merely things and their forces, but men and their ways, and the fashioning of the affections and of the will into an earnest and loving desire to move in harmony with those laws. For me, education means neither more nor less than this. Anything which professes to call itself education must be tried by this standard, and if it fails to stand the test, I will not call it education, whatever may be the force of authority or of numbers upon the other side. It is important to remember that in strictness there is no such thing as an uneducated man. Take an extreme case. Suppose that an adult man, in the full vigor of his faculties, could be suddenly placed in the world as Adam is said to have been, and then left to do as he best might. How long would he be left uneducated? Not 5 minutes. Nature would begin to teach him, through the eye, the ear, the touch, the properties of objects. Pain and pleasure would be at his elbow, telling him to do this and avoid that. And by slow degrees the man would receive an education, which, if narrow, would be thorough, real and adequate to his circumstances, though there would be no extras and very few accomplishments. And if to this solitary man entered a second Adam, or better still, an Eve, a new and greater world, that of social and moral phenomena, would be revealed. joys and woes, compared with which all others might seem but faint shadows, would spring from the new relations. Happiness and sorrow would take the place of the coarser monitors, pleasure and pain. But conduct would still be shaped by the observation of the natural consequences of actions, or, in other words, by the laws of the nature of man. To every one of us, the world was once as fresh and new as to Adam, and then, long before we were susceptible of any other mode of instruction, nature took us in hand, and every minute of waking life brought its educational influence, shaping our actions into rough accordance with nature's laws, so that we might not be ended untimely by too gross disobedience. Nor should I speak of this process of education as past for anyone, be he as old as he may. For every man, the world is as fresh as it was at the first day, and is full of untold novelties for him who has the eyes to see them. And nature is still continuing her patient education of us in that great university, the universe of which we are all members, nature having no test acts. Those who take honors in nature's university, who learn the laws which govern men and things and obey them, are the really great and successful men in this world. The great mass of mankind are the poor, who pick up just enough to get through without much discredit. Those who won't learn at all are plucked, and then you can't come up again. Nature's pluck means extermination. Thus the question of compulsory education is settled so far as nature is concerned. Her bill on that question was framed and passed long ago. But like all compulsory legislation, that of nature is harsh and wasteful in its operation. Ignorance is visited as sharply as willful disobedience. Incapacity meets with the same punishment as crime. Nature's discipline is not even a word and a blow, and the blow first, but the blow without the word. It is left to you to find out why your ears are boxed. The object of what we commonly call education, that education in which man intervenes, and which I shall distinguish as artificial education, is to make good these defects in nature's methods, to prepare the child to receive nature's education, neither incapably nor ignorantly, nor with willful disobedience, and to understand the preliminary symptoms of her displeasure, without waiting for the box on the ear. In short, all artificial education ought to be an anticipation of natural education, and a liberal education is an artificial education, which has not only prepared a man to escape the great evils of disobedience to natural laws, but has trained him to appreciate and to seize upon the rewards which nature scatters with as free a hand as her penalties. That man, I think, has had a liberal education, who has been so trained in youth that his body is the ready servant of his will, and does with ease and pleasure all the work that, as a mechanism, it is capable of, whose intellect is a clear, cold, logic machine, with all its parts of equal strength and its smooth working order, ready, like a steam engine, to be turned to any kind of work and spin the gossamers as well as forge the anchors of the mind, whose law is stored with a knowledge of the great and fundamental truths of nature and of the laws of her operation, one who, no stunted ascetic, is full of life and fire, but whose passions are trained to come to heel by a vigorous will, the servant of a tender conscience, who has learned to love all beauty, whether of nature or of art, to hate all vileness, and to respect others as himself. Such a one, and no other, I conceive, has had a liberal education, for he is as completely as a man can be in harmony with nature. He will make the best of her, and she of him. They will get on together rarely. She as his ever beneficent mother, he as her mouthpiece, her conscious self, her minister and interpreter.
Listening in and speaking out. Great Things We Now Know by Nigel Hawks. The greatest invention of the past 1,000 years is the printing press. Without movable type, credited to a Chinese engraver Bi Sheng in 1040, but not introduced into Europe until the 15th century, the explosive growth of knowledge, literacy, and even democracy would not have been possible. The printed book was an enabling technology, one that made many others possible. While the modern world might exist without, say, the telescope or the sextant, it is impossible to imagine it without newspapers, books, or libraries, because printing provides a means of building, generation by generation, on the experience of the last. It removes human evolution from the chance of nature and puts it in man's own hands. The computer and the internet, huge inventions though they are merely another step in the process that began with Gutenberg and Caxton 500 years ago. Small wonder that printing gained the most nominations from a group of scientists and thinkers assembled last year by New York literary agent John Brockman on his electronic salon called Edge. They were asked to nominate the greatest inventions of the past 2,000 years. Motive power is second only to printing as a key technology. Animals, wind, and water mills powered medieval machines, but steam power, a largely British development, drove the Industrial Revolution. The first steam engine to do a job of work, Thomas Savery's steam pump for draining mines, began operations just over 300 years ago in 1698. Improvements by Thomas Newcomen and James Watt made it into a source of rotative power for factories. All the subsequent prime movers, steam and gas turbines, and internal combustion engines, even nuclear power, have built on the success of steam in manufacturing and mobility, not opened fundamentally new directions. The notion of time is inseparable from the invention of clocks that will keep it. If we disregard Chinese water clocks and concentrate on mechanical timepieces, they fall neatly into this millennium. The oldest surviving clock in England, at Salisbury Cathedral, dates back to around 1290. The first clocks had no hands, but simply struck the hours to awaken monks for their devotions. The development of clocks with hands changed society. As Daniel Hillis, computer scientist, puts it, it converted time from a personal experience into a reality independent of perception. It gave us a framework in which the laws of nature could be observed and quantified. And the mechanism of the clock gave us a metaphor for the operation of natural law. Few other inventions had implications this profound, but the electric telegraph was one. It was the progenitor of all the communications technologies that have since turned the world into a global village. Telephone, fax, radio, TV, and even the internet. The first practical telegraph was developed by Charles Wheatstone and William Cook in 1837. For the first time, it was possible for two people far apart to be instantaneously in contact with one another, a facility we now take for granted. In this century, the computer has had an effect just as dramatic. Many of its pioneers worked in Britain. Charles Babbage in the 19th century, Alan Turing, and teams at Cambridge and Manchester universities in the 20th. To begin with, the computer seemed a rather specialized machine, of interest only to scientists and large corporations. A banal application, word processing, made it universal. And its ability to store, manipulate, and communicate huge amounts of information created the first real transformation of publishing since Caxton.